Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we've got Dr. Christopher Elder, a Clinical Assistant Professor of Neurology in the Comprehensive Epilepsy Center at NYU Langone Health. He joined the show to talk about the latest updates in the care of patients with epilepsy, the clinical therapeutic pipeline and the developments that are on the horizon, and the continued need to stress conversations around sudden unexpected death in epilepsy or SUDEP. So let's dive in.
My name is Chris Elder. I'm one of the epilepsy specialists at NYU. Recently just came over to NYU from Columbia. Prior to that, I was at UCLA and then at NYU for a residency. I think probably we'll start on the treatment side since some of these are, I guess, even newer than some of the understanding. And also it seems like there's probably more of them and they're much more applicable to a lot of the providers and doctors that will be listening. So big picture is that there's this rise of neurostimulation. And basically for our listeners who are general neurologists or other types of neurologists, I'm sure they're quite familiar with things like DBS for Parkinson's disease, things basically that can get implanted in the brain and will provide stimulation. In epilepsy, DBS has recently been approved and has now been shown to have quite a bit of benefit in patients with focal epilepsy. RNS is responsive neurostimulation, or NeuroPace is the company, is also something that has been in use and really seems to be just getting better and better with time. At this point, RNS is sort of basically the difference between RNS and DBS is that RNS has the ability to record seizures, and so they can kind of actively determine when a seizure is happening and will stimulate only when a seizure is occurring or concerning discharges, things like that. And DBS is really more, set it and forget it. You're just going to program things like that. You're going to stimulate it at a certain, parameters, and that's going to be that. DBS has some slight ability to kind of detect overall big picture long-term, this is our seizure frequency range. But RNS really does seem to have the edge as far as quantifying seizures.
And then what's been kind of the impact from these? Because obviously, again, this is a bit of a, for lack of a phrasing, I guess, detour from the traditional sort of anti-seizure medication route that patients have been exposed to. What's kind of been the impact? Because I imagine, too, a lot of times when new treatments come out, particularly something like this, where we're kind of deviating from what's been traditionally done and moving into this new realm of treatment, you tend to see this only at these sort of larger academic centers. Has the uptake been, widespread enough in the past couple of years that this is really starting to affect patients on like a wide scale? Or are we still kind of seeing a lot of benefit, but only in these sort of larger specialist centers?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of these neurostimulators are being implanted now in an increasing number of locations. We know that implantation is safe, and we know that there is long-term benefit. And so a lot of times patients, overall big picture, about a third of patients are going to have what's called refractory epilepsy or epilepsy that doesn't respond to just anti-seizure medication. And those patients, in the past, it was like, well, some of you can get a surgery, maybe some of you can't. But now there's a huge increase in the number of patients who could be eligible for some kind of significant reduction in seizure frequency. And so just because you can't get an epilepsy surgery, or just because you don't want an epilepsy surgery, you don't want part of your brain removed, or, even some kind of higher risk procedure, right? You now have the ability to have something that's maybe less invasive, or I should say, maybe less likely to have any kind of long-term consequences.
Yeah, I know, obviously, like epilepsy surgery is one of those. It's been a long road to kind of get where we've been. And I know there's still a lot of hesitancy on the patient side, even among those who could be good candidates. Do you find, you know, just anecdotally in your practice that patients are a little more receptive to the idea of something like DBS or RNS versus, you know, surgery or ablation even?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I guess I should probably clarify that there are also other things besides just neurostimulation that have sort of increased lately. And so one is, as you hinted at, laser ablation. And so that is another type of procedure that can be done. And basically what that is sort of a much smaller area that is targeted with sort of a focused, I guess, temperature kind of laser treatment. And basically what happens is there's some ablation there. It's sort of minimally invasive. Recovery is very good. And long-term, they have pretty good seizure outcomes when it comes to seizure freedom. And so that also is on the rise and has been getting a lot of attention. And actually, patients have been really interested in that too. So, you know, getting a craniotomy, you know, opening up the skull and going in, you know, some patients, that's really their best bet. And there unfortunately is a resistance on the part of a lot of patients and even some doctors where, you know, when patients are good candidates for resective surgery, you know, that's their best chance of being seizure free. And that is the best thing for them. But in patients who are not eligible for that or not candidates for that, or even patients who don't want that, you know, all these other things are now options. And so there's a lot of reception to it. A lot of patients really like having this choice. But again, it kind of also adds to some of the layers of complexity of figuring out, you know, what treatment is appropriate for which patient. And that's, you know, one of the challenges is getting patients kind of through that process. It takes time and there's a lot of testing, right? We cross all of our T's and dot all of our I's. It's a process.
Yeah, I can imagine that is, you know, and it's one of those, unfortunately, that's where we're at. We just got to go through that process. But having those options, I'm sure, is really kind of creating a much more, again, kind of speaking to that resistance that we've seen from patients and even physicians on the surgery angle, you know, kind of helping get a more cohesive plan together, I imagine. And then I'm curious for you, you know, when it comes to sort of the things down the road that are still in development, you know, is there anything you've kept your eye on or you think is particularly promising or again, might kind of make another impact on the therapeutic landscape in the next, you know, 3 to 5 or even say as far out as 10 years from now, you know, is there anything, like I said, that's really kind of stuck out to you as, you know, this is what I'm keeping my eye on?
Yeah. I mean, so actually before we even move on to future directions, there are some other things that I just feel like I have to go over. And so, you know, one other thing that has come out or been approved recently is a medication called Xcopri or cenobamate. And this medication, I'll be honest, I was skeptical. I tend to be more skeptical by nature. But basically, one of the findings is that this medication seems to be more effective in patients who are medication resistant or what we call refractory, you know, patients with refractory epilepsy. So basically, in, you know, the big picture over time, you have anti-seizure medication, right? And so you have anti-seizure medications as old as, you know, Dilantin or if you put, you know, Barbital, all that sort of stuff. And over the years, really what's happened is medication has not really gotten more effective in reducing seizures, right? It's just they've gotten fewer side effects, right? And so the trend has been fewer side effects. Actual efficacy in seizure reduction has really not been consistently demonstrated. And so with this medication, it actually appears that that's not the case, that basically it actually has had some benefit in seizure reduction, even in patients who are previously considered to be refractory. So I suspect in the future, patients with focal epilepsy who would be considered for epilepsy surgery basically won't be considered candidates unless they have tried Xcopri or tried cenobamate or, you know, or that medication has failed them. And so really, I think that probably I would not be surprised in the future if before patients can be, you know, evaluated for epilepsy surgery, that they will be required to be on that medication.
Yeah, that's an interesting one you brought up, and I'm glad you did, because that does kind of spark. I know at AAN this year, we spoke with Jackie French actually about that and how she was saying, you know, this is the first time we are really seeing kind of that refractory number go down potentially. You know, do you think that could be a signal that you know, maybe there might be an ability again. I don't know how many synovomates there are going to be right in the next 10 years where we improve on that number because it's been so difficult. But do you think that this has maybe opened the door to exploring different options or looking at different treatment pathways? Maybe we can mimic this in some way in a different delivery form or whatever to kind of continue to cut down on that number of patients who are refractory, because I know that is a very, it's very common in epilepsy and it's a very difficult thing to treat. And again, it seems like, you know, speaking to what we're talking about earlier, a lot of these other options are almost like, hey, we got to work around that because we can only reduce your seizures so much with, you know, these actual medications we're giving you.
Yeah. I mean, there's always potential. And I think that, you know, the idea would be that we just have to find it. And so, you know, as we go on, it seems like we're doing a better job at evaluating these drugs. And I know, unfortunately, it takes a long time before these medications, you know, they kind of go through the pipeline, they kind of get evaluated for safety and then, you know, for effectiveness and everything like that. And so it takes a long time for these medications to get approved and get evaluated even. And so there are a lot of medications that are in the pipeline that we don't know if they're working, if we don't know if they will work, or what benefit they'll derive. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. There's certainly potential for even better, I think. As far as which medication that will be and when that will happen, you know, that's I have no idea. That's speculative, but we'll see. I think we can be optimistic about that, you know, over time, medications will continue to get better. They'll get more effective and they'll be better tolerated.
So, I mean, that kind of brings us back to what I had asked earlier, you know, what are you kind of keeping your eye on? Just whether, again, it's in sort of some of these pipeline therapies that are coming out or again, getting into, kind of the gene therapy route that's sort of starting to be explored. You know, are there any of those pathways that you think look particularly promising based on what we know now?
Yeah, I mean, so I think specifically for medications, you know, so XCOPRI is right now being evaluated for effectiveness in generalized epilepsy. And so one of the major challenges that we struggle with now is what to do for patients with refractory generalized epilepsy. So patients with refractory focal epilepsy have a lot of options. Patients with refractory generalized epilepsy, they have fewer options. And so what we're hoping for now is that there will be some benefit, whether, you know, pharmacologic or surgical, that we will be able to provide these patients. And so a lot of medications and these surgical treatments are being evaluated for patients with refractory generalized epilepsy. So I won't be surprised if XCOPRI has some benefit in generalized patients, which would be really nice. Right now, they're also looking at the neurostimulators for generalized epilepsy, basically, you know, thalamic placements, things like that, that have been done over years. And basically what they're seeing and what we're hoping to see is that there's some improvement over time as well. Otherwise, though, you know, as far as specific pathways, so I'm aware that there are some interesting medications, some positive allosteric modulators of GABA, which are kind of like, if you're, the audience is familiar with benzodiazepines, these are more like non-sedating benzodiazepines. I think there are some potassium channel modulators, which may be coming out as well. I think they're starting like a phase 3 trial with Xenon Pharmaceuticals. Not sure about, there's some others that maybe as well. I know that there's neuronal stem cells, right? Although, you know, I'll be honest, I'm relatively skeptical about that. I think that, you know, kind of overpromise, underdeliver consistently. But yeah, I think that there's a lot of potential stuff coming down the pipe. So it should be a very exciting 5 to 10 years.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Elder to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, the FDA has given the green light to Rafa Laboratories for its 10 milligram midazolam auto-injector for the treatment of status epilepticus in adults. It is the first auto-injectable product to be approved by the FDA for this indication, joining several other rescue treatments with different routes of administration. Notably, the NDA review was sped up via prioritized engagement between the FDA and the DOD, as in addition to its use in the treatment of prolonged seizures, the auto-injector is also able to be used as a treatment for seizures resulting from nerve agent exposure. Next, Noble Pharma America has announced that its sirolimus topical gel 0.2%, marketed as Hyftor, has become commercially available in the United States. The therapy is a topical medication, the first for this indication, that was approved in March 2022 for the treatment of facial angiofibroma associated with tuberous sclerosis complex in adults and children ages 6 years and older. Next, the FDA has lifted its clinical hold on Part B of the Phase 2 MOMENTUM trial of SRP-5051, Sarepta Therapeutics' investigational treatment for patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy who are amenable to exon 51 skipping. The hold, which was placed in June 2022, came after a case of hypomagnesemia after treatment with high-dose SRP-5051. As a result of this lift, Sarepta will now need to adjust the global trial protocol to include expanded monitoring of urine biomarkers as part of the risk mitigation and safety monitoring plan. Next, the FDA and Philips Respironics have recalled several of the masks that are used with BPAP and CPAP machines because of serious safety concern. The recalled masks, which include the Amara View full face mask, the Dream Wisp nasal mask, the Wisp and Wisp Youth nasal masks, and the Therapy Mask 3100NC/SP, each of which have magnetic headgear clips to hold them in place that can cause potential injuries or death, as well as interfere with certain metallic medical devices and metallic objects in the body. And finally, after agreeing to reconvene for a second time, the FDA's Peripheral and Central Nervous System Drugs Advisory Committee has voted that the current data on AMX-35, an investigational Amylyx Pharmaceuticals agent for the treatment of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, is in fact sufficient in demonstrating efficacy. In a turn from its first meeting, this time the panel voted 7-2, 7 in favor, 2 against, in favor of recommending it for FDA approval as it nears its scheduled PDUFA date of September 29th, 2022. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com or you can check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Elder.
Yeah, I mean, do you see a pathway for, you know, because it does seem like, again, like there are some, you know, very specific patient populations who might benefit from these gene therapies. And I know that, like, when conversations first started happening, or at least we started having these conversations about them, it was very early stuff in like 2018, 2019. So it's still kind of too early to tell what might work, what might not. And I know, again, we're still kind of in the testing phase of these things. And I wonder, you know, with so many areas of medicine and particularly so many areas of neurology where we're talking about these chronic diseases, you know, the idea or the promise of a gene therapy kind of one and done approach is obviously very, very exciting to think that we could potentially treat someone and for lack of better phrasing, solve a lot of their problems with one shot. But obviously there's a lot of challenges that come with that and a lot of worries about long-term data and stuff. So I'm curious for you, you know, what's the kind of timeline that, you know, you have in your head, particularly as someone who is a little skeptical of, you know, the overpromising of these areas, you know, do you think 10 years from now, 15 years from now, we could be entering kind of an area of precision genetic medicine, so to speak, in epilepsy, or are we still kind of way too far away to start talking about those things?
Short answer is I don't know. I would say that I know already they're starting to do some treatments, although not gene therapy specifically. I think we're doing more sort of RNA therapy, or what's called RNA manipulation with something called an antisense oligonucleotide. I know we're actually doing that trial with Stoke Therapeutics at NYU. And so, you know, I'm optimistic it's hopefully going to be for patients with what's called Dravet syndrome, associated with a specific mutation. I think over time, you know, we're seeing this explosion in basically genetic mutations that we can identify with epilepsy. Sometimes, you know, I think it's going to take some time before we really kind of solidify that. I would say majority of patients that we have are not going to be, you know, identifiable with a single specific genetic mutation. And so I think that, you know, part of that is because seizures themselves are not, you know, unique to people who have genetic mutations, and everybody can have a seizure. It just takes a certain amount of stressors or a certain type of stimulation that happens that will cause that. And so I think that it will be challenging, although and we'll see. So I think that we'll see, you know, the potential is definitely there, but I think that there's probably, I would say, more than 10 years off.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like it's going to be a long-term kind of ride to that type, particularly, again, in this field, just because it does seem, you know, the like it's going to start with these rare populations with, Dravet, Lennox-Gastaut, those areas. So I'm curious for you, you know, you mentioned earlier some sort of areas that don't necessarily always get, I think, a ton of attention. And I'm curious, you know, for you, are there any challenges with treating epilepsy, like the generalized seizure population, you know, that you think kind of maybe need a little more attention or focus in these conversations? Because again, it does seem like across neurology, we're very focused on reaching this precision medicine goal. And I kind of wonder what in the meantime we could be addressing, kind of these smaller issues, so to say, that might kind of get pushed to the side because of these big idea conversations that are going on. So for you, is there anything like that kind of sticks out or that you wish got a little more attention?
Yeah, there are a lot of things. I think one thing that we need to do better at as a field in medicine is early recognition of epilepsy. And so there's a series of papers that came out by a colleague of mine, Jake Pellinen at University of Colorado, where basically identifying that we don't do a very good job figuring out when a patient comes in with a first time seizure versus when they've been having, you know, non-motor seizures and then, you know, come in with a first lifetime convulsive seizure, first lifetime motor seizure. And so that, you know, inherently kind of basically implies a major delay in diagnosis, a major delay in treatment. And that puts patients at risk, right, of all sorts of problems and long-term consequences. And so the diagnostic delay is a big issue that we need to be better with, you know, certainly with our neurologists and other non-neurologists in particular. The emergency room, I think, you know, the emergency room, they get a lot of stuff going on there. And sometimes it's hard to delineate, you know, well, you know, are you having other types of episodes, things like that. Can be very challenging, especially when a patient is postictal or kind of out of it or confused. It's hard to get a history. But I think that we can do better. And so I'm hopeful that with more attention, people will start to do better with that. The other things that we're noticing is that really patients or, well, doctors need to do a better job of recognizing which patients are refractory and kind of bringing up, you know, epilepsy surgery early and often. Patients, unfortunately, get this kind of view of brain surgery as, you know, negative, right? Think of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, right? You think of all these other stereotypes that have come out, but that's not what it's like. And, you know, epilepsy surgery is really very safe. And in general, you know, we're neurologists, we're not surgeons. So if you don't need surgery, you're not going to get it recommended by a neurologist. And so, you know, it's just something that I think that's another, you know, kind of this stereotype that we have to confront. I think another issue is what I'm starting to notice a lot, really, as I started practice, is just insurance coverage and prices of prescription drugs. And so, you know, these medications, if your insurance doesn't cover them, it's thousands of dollars, and it's just impossible for patients to get medications which are appropriate for them. A lot of times, you know, these medications won't be in stock, the patient has to wait for them, you know, they, you know, need to get medication, they need to get something bumped up, and it's just very challenging for them to get their medications. And it, you know, leads to a ton of seizures. You have patients who can be very well controlled and they miss their medications for a few days because, you know, they can't afford it or the insurance is delaying it, and then they can have refractory epilepsy from there on. And so it's just a very, you know, frustrating situation for everybody involved.
Yeah, and I imagine those two issues kind of can feed into each other a little bit too. You know, we talk about the delayed diagnostic, and I remember one of those papers actually that you brought up, and sort of I know in one of them they pointed to the number of car accidents that occur because of people not having motor seizures and they're unaware of seizures. And I know that we've had some conversations about, you know, the difficulty in educating the public about what a non-motor seizure feels and looks like. And then again, speaking to like the emergency department staff and the primary care physician community and getting them a little, you know, more up to speed on what's going on with these things to really kind of narrow down that delay in diagnosis. But then I imagine how frustrating it could be to finally get diagnosed and then have difficulty getting access to medication. You know, is there anything going on that you think might help address some of those challenges, or that we could potentially, you know, in the short term, try to do to address some of these challenges, or at least improve things a little bit? Because that's kind of, I mean, particularly the access issue and coverage issue, that's kind of across, you know, across the board in medicine. We've seen a lot of those difficulties. And I know, like, headache, it's the same thing. There are a ton of, you know, we get new medications that are targeted and much more efficacious, but the prior authorization process to get access to those is, you got to jump through a lot of hoops and patients end up suffering for a long time. And I imagine epilepsy can be kind of a similar scenario. So for you, I mean, what, you know, is there anything in the immediacy that you think physicians could do or to kind of try to alleviate some of those things?
Well, I think one thing in particular for as far as early recognition would be actually what was recommended by the author in some of those papers was basically instituting some kind of standardized questionnaires for people to use or for doctors to learn in training. You know, I remember even learning about like pain in medical school, and we had this PQRST scale. And so that's something that I think we could work on earlier, and making sure that people, really other doctors, have exposure to epilepsy in training. Kind of understand, you know, there's oftentimes bizarre experiences that patients will describe. A lot of times seizures are just beyond description. And, it, you know, it's not like primary care doctors or emergency room emergency room doctors are the only people who are, you know, causing the delay. Sometimes neurologists, you know, ourselves, we don't know, and epilepsy specialists too, right? And so it can be very challenging to sort of even make that diagnosis, period, even with, you know, some specialty training. So I think, you know, really just communication and education for people and kind of community outreach. I think, you know, certainly public explanation and kind of public education is a good idea too. It's definitely something that we can probably work on.
And one of the last things I wanted to ask you, and of course, obviously, if there's anything else you want to add, please feel free. But, you know, for you, again, it, you know, clearly there are some kind of ongoing challenges that still need to be addressed, but there's a lot of work being done. The pipeline is pretty busy. There's a lot of, you know, therapies that are kind of coming through. But for you, I mean, is there anything else that you think is important to mention, you know, related to either treatment or just kind of the day-to-day care of this patient population?
Yeah, I guess a couple of things that I would bring up. You know, the first thing that I think we need to do a better job as a whole is discussion about SUDEP, or sudden unexpected death in epilepsy. And, you know, this is something that we really don't do a great job of communicating to our patients about. A lot of doctors don't really pay attention to it. So it's something that we need to spend time counseling about, just period, across the board. And it's something that, you know, a lot of times if you tell patients about this, they'll be like, oh my God, what? And, you know, it'll be like, nobody told me about this for 20 years, right? And so I think that that's definitely something that, you know, I think it's just something that patients need to know about. And I think that doctors need to know about too, because sometimes, you know, you're like, all right, well, you just have epilepsy, you're just going to have seizures for 10, 20 years, like that's going to be that. But, you know, 1 in 1,000 patients, right, may experience SUDEP each year. And so it's something that we need to be aware of, and patients need to know, because you can't have patients who are, you know, having seizures for 20, 30 years, right, because at some point they become, you know, you're thinking the clock is ticking, right? This is something that is dangerous and something we want to prevent. And so in addition to all the long-term consequences of epilepsy, you know, memory impairment, right? All the potential consequences of physical injury, right? Disability, cognitive and sort of psychological consequences of having epilepsy, right? SUDEP, right? And it's something that patients need to know about. Sometimes patients are, you know, more hesitant to move forward with workup and treatment of this. And they're like, you know what, like I'm sort of comfortable with where things are. But, you know, sometimes it's our job to kind of give them the reality. And I think that it goes across, you know, doctors and fields and, you know, patient and everything. So it's something that we need to do a better job with. What I can tell you is that personally, it can be a more upsetting and uncomfortable conversation, and it requires time. And you have to be able to, you know, have the time to spend 5 to 10 minutes to talk to a patient about this, because obviously it's terrifying and it's very scary. And, you know, you really want to be there to tell them, hey, you know, this is a possibility, right? But there's hope, right? We can get you seizure free. And I think that's like the main message that you want to really communicate to the patients is that, hey, listen, okay, you're having seizures. Well, guess what? There's treatments that are available for you. And just because, you know, X or Y isn't working doesn't mean that Z won't work. And so I think that's really the biggest change over the years, is that we've gone from just being like, well, you know, take Dilantin for the rest of your life and, you know, I'll see you every 6 years or so, to now being like, well, you know, you've been on two seizure medications, and you know, now you have all these other options available to you. And that's true for both focal epilepsy and generalized epilepsy. And I'm hoping that over time, those options just grow. And I'm hoping over time that there are fewer refractory epilepsy patients because we get better drugs.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.